Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the first hour. In this first hour, we are going to focus a fair bit on the metal sector, but we're also going to get a couple comments at the tail end of the show on a more general basis, trying to understand just where money is flowing. To kick off this show, I am chatting with Jeff Christian. He is the managing partner over at CPM Group. And Jeff, one thing that I know a lot of people are asking you, and you even said after this trip pretty much around the world that you went on, talking to a lot of large investors and different funds, that there's a lot at play for the precious metals right now. What are some of the key factors that you are outlining to the groups that you consult for?
Well, I think one of the big things that we've always done is we talk about the economy and the financial markets, interest rates and the dollar. There are a lot of people talking about potential economic weakness and a recession in 2019, falling interest rates, falling dollar. And we're not necessarily sure that that's what you're going to see. I think that there's obviously a pause in the Fed's rate increases, but I think I wouldn't be surprised to see the Fed raise interest rates in the second half of the year, depending on where the economy goes. I think the economy in the United States and many other countries will probably continue to be stronger than people expect, the same way it was last year. So we've been spending a lot of time talking about, what the Fed's policies seem to be, where the interest rates seem to be going, whether the dollar is going to rise or fall, what's going on with the stock market. Brexit is obviously very important, as are various issues and problems in the U.S. government. So we've been spending a lot of time talking about these sort of macroeconomic factors, because that's really what drives investors into or not into gold and to some extent silver. Also, the fundamentals are changing. I mean, platinum is looking tighter. The palladium market is very high. Silver market fundamentals are pretty weak right now and need to have some attention paid to them. So we're finding institutional investors and high net worth individuals who want to sort of review the fundamentals and also review the economics and also understand really where the markets are and how they're operating these days, because there have been some big structural changes over the last decade in financial markets and in commodity markets in terms of the number of participants involved and how they buy and sell metals. So we're doing a lot of that kind of discussion. And then there's obviously the discussion about where we think the prices are going.
All right, Jeff, I want to first revisit that one comment that you made, that you think economies might be stronger than expected. And last year we had that one driver that can be attributed to the tax cuts. Plus, we had just more money flowing into the U.S. because you could make the argument that other economies around the world were weak. Do you see any certain drivers to the economies this year that can help keep them stronger?
Yeah, well, obviously we're not going to see the tax cuts. But I do think that the U.S. economy, for all of its perceived weaknesses on the horizon, it's still relatively strong. And what we saw last year was in the first quarter of last year, a lot of people moved into gold and gold prices got up to about $1,380 based on the view that the economies were weak and, there could be a recession in the United States and the stock market could fall. And, the stock market did fall in the last 4 months of the year, but it rose to new highs in the first 8 months of the year. So I see a similar pattern. Obviously, we don't have the tax cuts, but there is, for all of the signs that the economy is reaching mature stages, demand is still relatively strong in many sectors. Housing's showing problems, but the housing market continues to plug away. Autos are a little bit weak, but they're not as weak as some people thought they would be a month or two ago. So we see the economy kind of topping out or moving toward a top this year, but not necessarily falling sharply or going into recession mode. And I think that sort of sets up the precious metals markets for a pattern somewhat similar to last year, where you saw the price, you know, surge in the early, in the first quarter of the year on economic concerns. And then when the economy wasn't as weak as people thought, they sort of backed away. And I think that that could happen in the second quarter. Then in the second half of the year, I think we might start seeing some more issues related to the stock market, and that could actually help support gold. So, you know, we're looking for the price to rise modestly this year, but not run away.
Okay. Hey, Jeff, I share a lot of those same insights with you, especially as we grind through this year, and very much it sounds like continue to build this base for the metals. But you did also mention these big structural changes that have happened within the markets in terms of different investors maybe showing some interest and where money has been flowing. Can you share a few more insights on these structural changes, please?
Sure. Well, one of the things we've watched for the last couple of years was in 2017 and early 2018, you saw a lot of traditional gold and silver investors backing away from the market, people who were buying gold and silver because they expected a financial collapse. And in some cases, they were just just saying, no, it's not happening. In some cases, they were dying and their heirs were selling their precious metals. But even as that was occurring, you saw generalist investor funds becoming more interested in gold and silver in 2017 and the first half of 2018. And what happened in the second half of 2018 is those guys kind of backed away from the market. So you've seen a shift in who's interested in buying and selling gold and silver, both in ETFs and futures and physicals. And then you've also had this big decline. We've been doing some research on the futures markets and the OTC markets, and you've had a big decline in the number of commodity trade advisory firms, commodity pool operators, and hedge funds that actually get involved in precious metals as futures or options or forwards or OTC trades. And of the companies that still say that they're involved in precious metals in those paper markets, the vast majority of them seem to be technically driven as opposed to macroeconomically or fundamentally driven. So they're really just looking at price momentum, and they're buying when the price is rising and selling when the price is falling.
Is that the situation that we're in right now, though, is that so many traders are technical traders, and without any sort of a breakout in the precious metals, it's hard to expect a lot of these guys to all of a sudden come into the sector? It's really a story of the gold bugs, your standard gold bugs kind of dying off, unfortunately.
Yeah, the standard gold bugs are dying off to some extent. There are new ones coming into the market. And, you know, governments around the world work very hard to create new gold bugs by giving us all kinds of reasons to be worried in the long run. So I think that that'll be there. But you've got a lot of other people who are more opportunistic, and they will not be involved in precious metals for 20 years. But then when the price starts rising, they'll rush in, and they're experts. You know, and then when the price starts falling, they rush out and they forget about it for 20 years. And I think that that is a pattern that we've seen repeatedly over the last 30 years. It probably is going to continue. But I'll say this, it's not just gold. I mean, you're seeing this kind of pattern of more algorithmic trading across financial markets. There's a far less intellectual content in fund management than there used to be. And it's not just gold. It's really across assets.
Yeah, that's a very good point. A lot of these generalists that simply want to play the trend, and they don't care what trend or what sector they are playing. I also want to talk to you about a trend that we have seen in the metals, precious metals sector, and that is a consolidation of the majors. Kind of at the top of the pyramid, we've seen the biggest companies get together now and work, or well, they sound like they are working through their projects and their operations. How have you been telling the people that you've been talking to about the impacts on the market and even some of the opportunities that will become available?
Well, we've cautioned our clients for years that, you know, a lot of the large gold mining companies they're not geared up for growth. They're struggling to replace their reserves year in, year out, and they're not particularly attractive to investors. And that, you know, we've always said that our clients should look for companies that generate good profits and not measure success in terms of the number of ounces you have, but rather, you know, the dollars of profit that you have. And what we're seeing is that some of the big gold mining companies are not doing that. They're continuing to try to get more ounces, even if it doesn't mean more profits. And as a result, you've seen a couple big mega mergers announced late last year and early this year. And those mergers, when you get those two large companies put together, there are any number of attractive smaller deposits that they have that they might be looking at to develop that they will now slough off and look to sell because they just make even less sense for an ever larger company. So one of the trends that we're seeing is, you know, mid-tier and smaller mining companies and institutional investors and entrepreneurially oriented investors starting to look at the portfolio of undeveloped properties that these guys have, and in some cases developed properties, and say, well, what's available for purchase here and how do I go about it? And, you know, okay, obviously the mining company is going to want to run an auction process to get the best possible price. But can I approach these people before they start the auction process and say, hey, let's talk about ways that we might, you know, buy the XYZ property off of you. So I think that the attitude that we're seeing in the industry and among larger investors is, what are the opportunities here to pick up stuff that these newly larger companies might not want?
Yeah, I share those same optimistic thoughts that there are some properties that these large guys just will not pay attention to, and they will offload. But if we drive down even further into some of the juniors and exploration companies, it was a trend that we saw throughout this bottoming process, and that is really the major funding coming from some of these large companies taking equity positions in these exploration companies. Do you think that the majors will still be looking at doing this while they're trying to sort out their operations, or will this now fall on some of the mid-tiers or some of these royalty and streaming companies?
I think the majors will do a little bit of it. I think they'll do less than they had been doing. It's going to fall more on the mid-tiers and the streamers, as you say. And it's probably also you'll probably also see some of these mid-tiers now become targets for acquisitions as these guys look to build their reserves, because they're in even more dire condition of needing to have additional reserves to replace the reserves they're mining every year as they get larger and larger.
Okay. And you know what? One thing that you even said, it's what investors would like to see more of is these major companies start to run their companies like profitable companies, not just adding these ounces to their balance sheet. But during your trips around the world and with the different groups that you met with, would you say that there are new groups starting to pay attention to the metals sector for whatever reason it might be?
We saw that trend, as I said, we saw that trend emerging in 2017 and early 2018, and there was a backing away in the second half of 2018. There are some groups that we're talking to that are new as investors in the sector, but it's probably, you know, I think the price weakness that we saw in gold and silver in the last three quarters of last year has sort of caused a lot of those guys to pause in their enthusiasm toward moving into the market. And, you know, we're trying to help them realize that this is a good time to buy. You know, one of the themes that we're working with our clients on this year is a time to accumulate. But this is a time when prices have not started rising sharply again yet. And it's probably a good time to be accumulating both precious metals and precious metals equities, because we do think that, you know, prices will rise in the next 5 to 7 years sharply.
So, Jeff, just one more quick comment on some of these structural changes and the different investors that could come into the sector. One argument I think can be made for some of these new groups that are more generalist funds is that now there are so many different ETFs to play either the actual price of gold or to play a portfolio of gold companies that they're not as enticed to actually dive into whatever number it might be, these thousands of gold companies out there, and make their own active investments. Do you see this being a bit of a hamper for individual companies?
Definitely. The fact that you can avoid all of the management risk, country risk, operational risk, performance risk, reserve risks, by just going into an ETF is definitely a factor. And I think that because the mining share prices have underperformed, I mean, the argument against that is that you have a better beta. You know, if gold prices rise, traditionally gold mining shares rise more. And a lot of that's diminished because of the bad performance of the stock prices over the last couple of years. So this, I think the mining industry is hard-pressed to make that argument that, yes, you can do the ETFs, but you'll get more bang for your buck if you choose mining companies. And it's a point that has been harder to make because of the bad performance of share prices over the last couple of years.
And I think on top of that, the poor performance of management teams as well, still draining the company of their funds, which unfortunately I don't see slowing down right now. Final comment though here, Jeff, and that deals with this overall bottoming process that it really looks like gold is putting in on that long-term monthly chart. Do you think, whether it's this year, next year, 3 years out, that the breakout of this range that gold is traded in will be to the upside or to the downside?
I think it's to the upside. I mean, you know, our view is that gold prices rise this year, that they trade between, say, 1280 and 1380, 1400 over the course of 2019, that in 2020 they're somewhat higher, so they're trading between, say, maybe 1340 and 1480. And then at some point, we think that the economic conditions and the budget deficits and the debt and the financial imbalances really cause economic ill-ease, which leads to a move upward in gold prices. Because, you know, the gold market saw a sharp diminution in the amount of gold, physical gold, that investors bought in 2018. And the price fell $200. If investors go back to where they were in 2017, 2016, in terms of the volumes of physical gold they want, the gold's not readily available. So they're going to have to bid the price up. And I think that the price will rise sharply simply because, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, people who own gold, generally speaking, hold on to it. So incremental increases in demand for gold from other investors because the economy is looking scary or the political environment scary, those incremental increases in demand have to be met by bidding the price up sharply in order to encourage other people to sell and take their profits. So when it happens, we think the breakout will be on the upside.
All right, there you have it from Jeff Christian, Managing Partner at CPM Group. Jeff, I really do appreciate all of your comments and you joining us on the KE Report on a regular basis to share what I think is a very balanced and level-headed approach to the precious metals sector. Have a great rest of your weekend, Jeff, and thanks again for your time.
Okay, great, thanks.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments that I spent with Jeff Christian over at the CPM Group. In this segment, I am getting a company update from Osisko Metals. Osisko Metals is traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol OM, and I am chatting with the president and CEO, Jeff Hussey. Jeff, there's been a few news releases that came out just over the last 2 weeks. Something that Osisko Metals has consistently produced is some very nice drill results from two of your major properties. The first one I want to talk about is Pine Point. We saw some headline numbers of almost 15% zinc and lead over 12.74 meters. And one important aspect is that consistently, all of the results that you have been seeing from Pine Point are all pretty much at surface, all within 30 meters of surface. Can you break down what these recent drill results mean?
Yeah, thanks, Corey. At the end of January, we announced another intersection and some other four holes from the East Mill Zone. So just to be clear, the East Mill Zone is between 30, maybe down as far as 50 meters. It's our shallowest zone at Pine Point. Other areas like the Central Zone and North Zone go down to about 100 meters. So just for clarity, but the East Mill Zone is the best near surface mineralization. 15% over 12 meters is high grade for that thickness. And so that was a great result to publish. We're still getting results from the drilling at the end of last year, the results coming in from the labs, and we're processing those and continuing to release them. We put out the resource, I think we discussed this last time, 38.4 million tons at about 6.6 zinc equivalent. And what we did is we incorporated, because we had to do a cutoff date back in September. The resource does include 20,000 meters of drilling, but we have an additional 40,000 meters to include into the next resource we do. This will help convert a large portion, the 60,000 meters in total, will help convert a large portion of that 38.4 million tons up into the indicated category when we use our surveying data, et cetera. So that's coming later this year. But what it does give us, the resource that we put out, the inferred resource, is 5.5 billion pounds of zinc and lead. You know, prior to this, it was historical resources. It wasn't 43-101 compliant, so therefore in the market it has no value. So we said we would get a resource out. We did in December. We've now converted the historical resources into what we call a pit constrain, because we use a Whittle pit. It's a mining software to figure out what is able to be mined open in an open pit. So we got a high-grade, large tonnage resource that's throughout the property of near-surface mineralization. And it's important to point out why this is different, why it's unique amongst our peers. 90% of mine production for zinc is underground. Yet some of the most profitable mines in the world, some of the biggest zinc mines, are the most profitable. So when you have near-surface zinc, it seems to be, as Cominco was known to be, a very profitable mining site. So that's what the resource tells us. And then when we put it into context, it's also worth noting why we're there. Most, like, we have low-cost hydroelectric power. The railhead's over at Hay River, about 60 kilometers away. So it allows us to rapidly advance the project. We don't have big infrastructure capital expenditures to incur, nor do we have to build them.
Well, and that's a key factor too. Infrastructure always important, especially when you're talking about these type of resources. You said that 5.5 billion pounds of lead and zinc, so crucial to have infrastructure close by. There's also a figure within that news release that focused on that East Mill Zone, and it outlined all of these modeled pits from that 2018 resource. A quick question, what do you think about the potential, or is there a potential or even benefit to tying together some of these smaller pits with some of the larger pits, or does this not even really matter because everything is so close to surface?
I'd say your last comment is closer to the truth. These are shallow pits. An example in the East Mill Zone, there may be 10 of them that are within, what it'll look like will be a long trench. So you'll go down, you'll get that mineralization throughout that deposit, a couple of hundred meters wide, a couple of hundred meters long, and then there may be an area where at that elevation, there isn't any mineralization or anything economic. So we would just ramp out of that pit and ramp back down. So it'll look like a big trench at the end, interconnecting pits, if you will. But at this point, we are identifying each of those deposits as a singular pit, but some of them will connect. It will not be the big circular or elliptical pits that go down at depth and you have to move a lot of dirt. Here, the ratio, the strip ratio that we put in the resource was about 7.7, but we left one deposit in that was actually, it should be mined underground, and it generated an enormous amount of waste. When you look at taking that deposit out and mine it conventionally as underground, the strip ratio comes down to about 5.3, which is much more reasonable, and that's what we'll be dealing with at the Pine Point site.
Okay, and then just remember, too, that as you outlined in that news release, that Osisko Metals is the only junior in the Americas with a pit-constrained inferred resource of 5.5 billion pounds. But you also have this other project, Keanacon, where you have released recent news just this week. The headline numbers, just over 12.5% zinc and lead, over 20 meters. This project doesn't have a resource around it yet. You do have one coming up, don't you?
Yeah, so just to clarify, there is a historical estimate of the main zone that is on file at the government in New Brunswick. It was basically what was known. Back in the 50s and 60s, they actually dropped a 460-meter shaft. They had 8 sublevels. They put in a ventilation raise, and they drilled off that main zone quite tightly, and that's what was left on the shelf. There was essentially no work done for 60 years. Noranda, the company I used to work for, had a couple of JVs. They did a number of holes, but the exploration was kind of sporadic. There was Rio Algum and Noranda, and no one really found enough and did not update that resource estimate. So we went in and we started drilling around these intersections, and we're seeing sizable deposits of mineralization. So that's what we've been drilling off. We drilled about 22,000 meters in the Bathurst, at Keanacon, 40,000 in the camp, but 22 just at Keanacon. And so we just came out with that intersection. Yeah, so this was in order to do the resource, we have to go back into where there is mineralization and duplicate an area. And this was one of the ones that needed duplication, so we're just reporting that in preparation. We hope to get the mineral resource estimate out here in Q1 and as soon as possible, but we're working on it right now to get that out.
Now, there's also another aspect of that intersection that has a silver component, and quite a high-grade silver component, 185 grams per ton, again, over that 20 meters. Now, it wasn't consistent across the board, those type of silver results, but there was another hole, 28, that had 132 grams per ton. What's the importance of this silver component?
Well, locally, it's very high-grade. I'd say, well, we'll see when we get the resource out, when it's all averaged out. But you usually get a couple ounces of silver in the ore in the Bathurst camp, depending on which deposit. There's potential here to get a little bit higher, but locally you do get some very high grades. At the same token, what you're trying to see is that the zinc and the lead combined, we always quote it as zinc plus lead for simplicity, that it'd be north of 10%. And you want mineable widths, while here you got 12.6%. And you got 20 meters. So that's the kind of, that's the heart of the zone that you want, where you can get substantial tons per blast.
Jeff, I also had a question come in that was asking from a more precious metals investor who is looking at this sector. Is there any way to convert, or can you give us any idea of what approximately 12 or 13% lead and zinc equals in terms of a precious metals component?
Yeah, I can give an estimate. It's a different type of calculation because of how much of the material recovered is payable by a smelter. So we took a look at that on a couple of different intersections, and when you use a long-term price with recoveries that vary per zinc, lead, copper, and silver, and then you use the payables that you'll get from a smelter, add those up, you know, it's about $245 rock at this for this headline intersection that we announced on February 7th, and that would convert roughly into about 7 grams per ton. So that's, again, if you look at that, it's an interesting grade, but in this case where it's 20 meters wide, it's even more so.
Absolutely. Yep. Some high grade results. And again, just remember that that resource is due out of Keanicon shortly, as you said, in Q1 of this year. What other work is going to be going on as that resource is getting ready that we can look forward to and expect as investors?
Well, we're quite happy to have been able to, within 2 years, get positioned in two of Canada's premier zinc mining camps and put out resources in both within that 2 year period, roughly. We started at Keanicon actually just after spring breakup last year, and we're putting out a resource, same as we started a little earlier at Pine Point, and we've come out with a resource. So we wanted to quickly do that to create value by converting historical resources that typically carry no value into NI 43-101 inferred. The one at Pine Point, as I mentioned, coming up, we're going to work towards getting an indicated resource base that will roll into economic studies. We're still figuring out how we want to approach that, but it's looking good. We have, a large part of that will be converted once we add the surveying data in, which is necessary to lock it in space, and all of the infill drilling will then be able to be used to bring it up from the inferred into the indicated. So we look forward to that at Pine Point. We will be getting that resource out before year end. At Keanicon, we need to go back in and drill. There will be some that will convert into resources, but when we look at the length that we have drilled at Keanicon, there's some of it will convert into resource, but some will be quote unquote exploration potential or exploration targeting. And that's what I'm looking forward to as well. There is a lot of sulfides, but it's sparsely drilled. So for Keanicon, there's more work to do to drill that off to get to that next step of a resource, and we look forward to doing that. In parallel, to these two mining camps, we're also generating blue sky in Quebec with our Quebec GenX program, and we raised a substantial amount of flow-through in the last quarter of last year. And we're in the process of being quite active by doing some airborne surveys and preparing a program for boots on the ground this summer. We do have a drill turning on that as we speak. We are also drilling in our joint venture with Osisko Mining in the eastern part of the Abitibi Greenstone Belt. So we are quite active in Quebec as well. But our main headlines have been generated by Pine Point and Keanicon. So investors can look forward to a quite active company that has multiple assets in the zinc space. Now, in the zinc space, we all know that inventories are at critical levels at 10 days consumption, and we're less than 6 days right now. Before Christmas, we were less than five or just around five. So the backdrop of the zinc metal market is very tight. There's uncertainty that has been created by the U.S.-China trade war. I think that in the first quarter or shortly after, there should be less uncertainty with a deal hopefully being struck at the beginning. And a lot of the people that are discussing the base metal space are waiting for just that. So we've seen since the beginning of the year that zinc has been the best performer on the LME alone. What we see is that once that negotiation is complete, I think that's when we may hear about global infrastructure projects, perhaps some stimulus in China. The United States have also talked about infrastructure projects recently and how they would like to increase. And any uptick in the demand for steel and galvanized steel from these global infrastructure projects in the context of a zinc market being at half its critical levels, I think we'll see a significant swing in the zinc price to the positive, which will typically benefit our stock and our value. And we look forward to that, combined with a lot of work to be done this year.
Yeah, all right. Well, you guys continue to be very active. And if there is that bump in zinc, like you mentioned, then I really do think Osisko Metals is positioned very nicely because of how advanced these projects are and how big these resources already are at some very nice grades. Jeff, I appreciate you taking some time this weekend and updating all of our listeners on what Osisko Metals is up to and what they all can expect. Thanks again for your time, Jeff. Have a great rest of your weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition. We're going to shift a little bit away from the metals and resource sector and talk more with Mike Larson. Mike writes the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Mike joins me every couple weeks for more of a generalist look at what's going on in the markets. And it's interesting because just this, well, today, actually on Saturday, Mike is presenting at the Money Show in Orlando. And we are talking about what his presentation is on. And it is more about where he thinks you can safely invest in still this environment where the argument can be made there is this Uber bubble sitting out there. Mike, can you break down some of the high-level points of where you do see some of still the opportunities and safety investments?
Sure. You know, like you mentioned, I'll be talking to investors today and looking at what's going on in the markets from a broader perspective. And I think what's really interesting is we've had this big rally, which a lot of people have talked about, like, oh my gosh, you know, the S&P, the Dow are up sharply in January and early February, which is true. But, you know, the flip side of that is that we were down incredibly sharply and lost so much ground in December that all we've done when you net it all out is tread water. I mean, we're exactly right now, we're trading roughly around where we were in early December. So we had panic and euphoria in the span of 2 months, but ultimately went nowhere. I think this kind of speaks to the overall market environment being much more volatile than it was in the prior several years. You know, we came through an extraordinary period of extremely low interest rates, extreme policy certainty, whether you're talking about political certainty or economic and monetary certainty, to now we're in this environment where, you know, people are running from one side of the boat to the other in record short amounts of time. And again, that leads to sort of really bad decisions if investors aren't prepared for it and don't know how to navigate these choppier seas. We had our hands held for us by central banks for so long that I think investors have sort of lost that muscle memory of how to actually invest and trade in a market where it takes more than just policy pronouncements to drive trading activity. So with that being said, my message is going to be that we're still in an environment where, and I've been saying it for a year, we're still in an environment where we have to be more cautious, more conservative, have higher levels of cash, and look for gains in sectors and stocks that aren't talked about on TV every day and that aren't as popular as the investments that used to work between sort of 2014, 15, 16, 17, and the beginning of 18. By that, I mean things like utilities, dividend-paying stocks, real estate investment trusts if they're in the right sectors, and so on. Those are the kinds of companies that I think still offer you some opportunity in this market and that give you some downside protection from yield and from their defensive nature. These are the kinds of companies that can still generate earnings in sales, even if the economy takes a turn for the worse. So, that's kind of what I've been preaching for a while now. What's interesting, especially in this market rally, is that it's being led by a very odd group of stocks. Historically, and especially before we had the market start to top out in early 2018, it was technology, it was FANG, it was all those very popular kind of companies, while everything else was pretty much falling by the wayside. In this rally, when I look at our Weiss Ratings data and just sort of analyze the character of this rally objectively, what I'm seeing is three groups tend to lead it: gold miners and REITs, and then technology. It's the weirdest sort of mix of stock sectors to be leading that I've seen in a long, long time. I mean, you typically buy gold and gold miners when you're looking for protection from chaos in the market and increased volatility. You typically buy things like REITs because they offer you dividend protection against downside risk and can still generate earnings, again, even in a riskier economy. But you would buy technology stocks when you're extremely confident about growth and the ability of these companies to kind of, grow into very extended valuations. So how the heck can you have all three of those groups rallying at the same time? It's very odd. You throw in things like low volume on this rally and the fact that we're extremely late in the economic and credit cycle, and it still is a suspect rally to me. When I first sort of flipped from being extremely bullish to being relatively bearish and defensive, that was in the sort of February-March timeframe of 2018, the stock market's basically exactly where it was back then now. So anybody who listened to me hasn't really lost anything at all by being cautious. And in fact, if you're in some of these sectors like REITs, if you're in some of the sectors like utilities, you've made a decent chunk of money. You know, the XLU ETF in the U.S. is up about 16% in the last year. The XLK, which is the technology ETF, is up about 7.5% in the last year. So you've made twice the money you could have made in technology, which they talk about every single day on TV, in defensive utility stocks. And again, that just shows that the need for yield protection, for some sort of insulation against volatility, and those types of things that come with investing in safe money stocks, not just the stuff they talk about on TV every 5 seconds.
So this is actually something that you and I have been talking about for a number of months now, is needing to be more selective and picking more of these defensive sectors. But as you said, there's these defensive sectors, but then there's also tech, which has been getting money coming into it. Do you think that is only going to be kind of a short-term bump? Maybe some of these more aggressive investors still trying to seek out some yield, but when they look back on it, whether it's in a month or at the end of this first quarter, they're going to realize that even though they might have some gains there, they're still missing out on much larger gains in some of these more defensive sectors?
I think if you're focused over, you're overly focused on technology and you're trying to chase these big short-term rallies, I think you're going to be sorry. I think that what's happened in the technology space is that these stocks became wildly overowned, overloved, overvalued. And especially when you look at some of these garbage IPOs that have been coming out in the technology space, I mean, we have more tech IPOs coming out right now, or in the last year, coming public. More of those companies are losing money in terms of not having any profits in the year or two before their IPOs, even than we saw at the peak of the dot-com bubble. So you have a bunch of lousy stocks that are able to get money in this market because too much money is flowing into technology. You have a lot of private tech companies that want to go public this year at absolutely ridiculous dot-com era valuations. Some companies, even some of these bigger ones that you talk about, I mean, Uber, we all use its services and so on, but it hasn't made a penny of operating profits on an annual basis in 10 years of operation. How do we know if it's even a real business? We don't. So I think that a lot of this risk and a lot of this behavior, just throwing money at technology stocks, ignoring the lessons of you know, 20 years ago, I think it's a lot of risk in that part of the market. You don't have that cushion from yield. You don't have that valuation cushion for sure. And you have a lot of business risk, especially if I'm right and we're very late in this economic cycle. You know, one thing that hasn't gotten talked a lot about is that banks, from some of the data from the Fed itself and from some of the data from the bankers trade groups, the data shows that delinquencies are starting to rise fairly notably and credit availability is starting to get tighter. There was a great report that comes out from the Fed every quarter that looks at banks, and just they go out there and they ask, hey, are you being more willing to make loans? If you are you seeing more or less demand? Are you charging people more to borrow and so on? They had one thing that looked at the cost of basically the spreads, how much extra interest you're charging somebody to borrow, a commercial borrower. That's actually the reading there was the highest since 2010. So banks are getting stingier with money. If you look at the data from the American Bankers Association on loan delinquencies, the consumer loan delinquency rate averaged over 8 different kinds of loans is the highest since 2013, 6 years ago. So really, you're in a situation where we certainly are not in a recessionary environment yet, but these types of things that are happening, banks getting less willing to make loans, more consumers defaulting on their loans and so on, that's what you see at the tail end of an economic expansion and what you tend to see as you're heading into a bear market. So again, I don't see anything in this rally that changes my opinion of where we are in the cycle. And I think you want to be more defensive. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't find select opportunities here and there, but it means you have to be more selective. You can't just throw money at these tech stocks they talk about every 5 minutes on TV and think you're going to make money in a sustainable basis.
Okay, you bring up some good points there, and it regards liquidity too, talking about how people might be defaulting on loans. It's tougher to get that free or easy money that was available in markets, but the other central banks, including the Fed now, have backed off of some of their more hawkish policies, and as you said, there's still this liquidity available for these garbage IPOs. Do you see liquidity drying up all of a sudden, or is this going to be a long process where eventually either it is through defaults or through even corporate defaults that liquidity dries up, and that's truly what hampers the market and drives everything down?
I think the process is already underway. If you look at, for example, things like housing price appreciation, it's been slowing pretty notably for, you know, several months now in terms of the rate of appreciation. Prices aren't falling, but they are slowing. In overvalued markets like California, you actually have in the month of December sales that are dropping at 20% to 25% year-over-year rates. If you look at the rate of appreciation in commercial property, it's been decelerating for a few quarters now. If you look at, say, the bond market, Treasury yields, and you compare the movement off the lows in Treasury yields versus the movement off the lows in stocks, it's night and day. The bond market doesn't believe that the economy is going to be growing again just as a result of what the Fed did. So that liquidity isn't driving really, you know, you would expect to see a yield curve steepen dramatically. You expect to see interest rates go up a lot if the, you know, bond market was convinced that there's going to be some new spurt of growth, but it's just not happening. So again, you're seeing the bond market much more skeptical of what's going on than you are, say, in stocks. And all this fits with that argument that we're sort of in that late cycle environment. And, you know, one thing I'd add too, some people haven't been in this business very long, but, you know, I've been involved in following interest rates and real estate and that credit cycle very closely since the mid-1990s. And what's very interesting to me, it's the same thing people say now about QE and about, you know, oh, the Fed can just step in and do what it wants to do, and that's going to save the markets. The same thing they're saying now is what these people were saying 20 years ago about interest rate cuts. But, you know, all the Fed interest rate cuts in the 2000 to 2002 bear market didn't stop the bear market. Throughout that point, the Fed was talking dovish and cutting rates, yet stocks kept going down. Obviously, the same exact thing happened again in the 2007 to 2009 bear market. I mean, you know, how many times did the Fed either cut rates or roll out one of these alphabet soup programs, TALF, TAP, you know, TAF and all that other garbage? And what happened? The stock market went down anyway. Ultimately, the only thing that kind of bottomed things out was that assets got cheap. Housing got cheap. Dot-com stocks crashed, and therefore there were some tech stock bargains amongst the wreckage. You know that, and I think that may be something similar that we see here. I see a lot of parallels between the early, you know, where we are now, sort of in this cycle, that we were early on in those last two bear markets. So again, it's not 100% confirmed. I'm keeping my eye on some things out there, and you know, I suppose things could change. But nothing I've seen has really changed the general narrative that we're very late in the cycle. You got to play defense. And unlike in the last 9 or 10 years, where shaking hands with the central bank made sense because you were still in the growth phase of the economic cycle and credit was still getting easier, that's not the case anymore. Shaking hands with the Fed is probably a silly thing to do now. And I think that's what the bond market is saying. Why would bond prices not be going down and interest rates not be going up if they believed that what the Fed was doing would change the economic outlook? And just one last thing on that point, this narrative that Fed pivots or pauses after a series of rate hikes is bullish. That's what they say on TV all the time. It would be great if it were actually true, but unfortunately, some of us actually look at the data. And if you go back the last quarter century, there's really only one bullish Fed pivot, meaning a time when the Fed stopped hiking rates, started getting worried about the downside after a series of interest rate hikes. The only time that was ever bullish in the last quarter century was 94 and 95. And then you had a few years after that, or 3 or 4 years after that, where the stock market just kept going up. That was it. The last two times, you know, was right at the peak of the dot-com bubble, right at the peak of the housing bubble. The economy obviously tumbled into recession not too long afterwards, and stocks fell very sharply. So I just don't think that, you know, you can have a lot of confidence that maybe the Fed's going to get this one right. And I think you just got to, you know, for now, continue to do what's been working for a year. Be in the defensives that are making more money than the stocks they talk about every day. Carry a higher level of cash, which is actually generating some yield because of the interest rate hikes to date. And just, you know, be on the lookout for more volatility and more, you know, more potential surprises. Because my opinion of what happened in December is that it's not all the turmoil we're going to see. It's more like an appetizer of a main course that's coming later.
So just to wrap us up, Mike, where does that leave the U.S. dollar then? I do agree that more people should be in cash and be ready to inject that money if we do get some sort of even more major or severe pullback. But you look at other countries around the world too, and their currency is also struggling. A lot of issues that we're seeing in their market. Do you see the U.S. dollar being that also kind of safety play?
You know, I've said for a long time that even though it's not the historical pattern, I think both the dollar and gold can go up roughly in tandem as risk-off safety-type plays. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. If you look, like you mentioned, some of these other countries are in a lot worse shape. The Australian Central Bank, just in the last several hours, last day or two, suggested that it might get more dovish. So the Aussie dollar is getting smacked on that. The euro can't seem to get off its downward trend against the dollar. It's been declining for some time because their economy is in very worse shape. You know, so there's a lot of problems elsewhere in the world. So I think by default, you know, the U.S. dollar might actually continue to rally. But I think that might actually happen in tandem with the rise in gold, because I think gold, again, is being purchased as protection, chaos insurance, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, really, if you look at since sort of the August, you know, the summer period, the dollar's been rallying. The U.S. dollar has been rallying since last May, June, and gold has been rallying since, you know, July, August timeframe. So they're already that thesis is already kind of playing out, where both gold and the dollar are rising in tandem. And I think that's likely to be the case, you know, for some time going forward.
All right, Mike, always great having you on the show. I hope that you do have a great money show in Orlando. And for everybody, I do thank you for tuning in to the first hour of this weekend show. Please keep in touch with me, fleck@kereport.com. Any of the companies that I interview or any companies that you think I should be reaching out to and having on the show, or at least talking to them, please let me know. I love getting emails from everybody. Hey, Mike, have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again for your time today.
Thank you.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.